Hello. Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Anxiety Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Daryl Tonema, a psychologist of Kiowa, Comanche, and Tuscarora heritage. He has three bachelor's degrees in psychology, sociology, gerontology, a master's degree in community counseling, and a PhD in counseling psychology and cultural studies. Dr. Tonema is a trauma-informed counselor who works with Native groups across the United States and Canada. Dr. Tonema, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So in speaking about anxiety, one thing I found is that one of the reasons it might take people a while to come to terms with their anxiety is that we've become very skilled at avoidance. We have technology, we have substances like food, drugs, and alcohol, all kinds of things to distract us and help us avoid discomfort, so much that we forget what it feels like to feel kind of fundamentally safe in the present. So I'd love to know what you tell people in the beginning of an anxiety journey to help them return to that state of safety.
Oh, that's an awesome question. Well, even before I even jump into all that stuff, I've had more folks in the past 6 months call me or shoot me an email saying they've had their first bout with anxiety or an anxiety attack or depression, really since COVID has really settled into the nervous system, and maybe the tools that they had been used previously, or maybe they're preloaded for some stressful stuff, and the extended season of COVID has really affected their responses. And nationally, you've seen the spikes in usage of alcohol or drugs or smoking, the COVID-15, so even eating. So folks have really used a lot of external tools to deal with internal events. And the smartphone, the TV, binge watching has become kind of a socially acceptable way of dissociating. And so engaging in something outside of myself. And I think even I'm guilty of binge watching, and honestly, for the sake of just unplugging from everything. I've done it, and everyone I know has done it. I think getting to the point where it becomes a pathology, where you're kind of addicted to things, that's kind of turning, you're seeing more of those things. So the first conversation I had is what's changed? How do you see yourself different? How do you know you're feeling more anxiety than you were before? What was it like before? I want to see what a baseline is. And then I want to know, what are they calling anxiety? What is the somatic? What does anxiety feel like? How do you know it's not something else? I want to see how they're discerning and how the states have changed, and what does it feel like that I'm labeling this different than this, and why I'm labeling the anxiety. I'm really curious about that. And then I want to see, well, what tools had you used previously and what tools are you using now? And that's where I've discovered more folks doing dissociation behaviors and using the external tools for the internal events. And for me, that's where I see the work beginning is, well, let's see what internal tools we can develop that shore things up, that give you a sense of sovereignty when you get those first inklings of what you're calling anxiety. Let's develop some tools around that rather than having to go to the store, turn on the TV, pick up a pack of smokes or a drink to address that. So that's kind of where I am now with the community and developing mutual understandings.
And I love that you said all of that, and that your first line of questioning is just like, what does that mean to you? How is it coming up for you? What's not working anymore? I relate to that so much, because when I had to come to terms with my anxiety, it was several years ago. And I was waiting outside the doctor's office for them to open, because I was like, I know something is wrong. And then in speaking to the doctor, he said the exact same thing. And I said, well, I do yoga. I exercise 6 days a week. I have a gratitude journal. I meditate. I was like, and I feel awful. And I can't experience joy anymore. I've lost the ability to play. Right. And he was like, God, it sounds like you're working really hard. And you must be exhausted. And I was like, yes, I'm working so hard to be happy and I'm so miserable. Right. So I just love that you named that as the thing that people can self-identify. Like, what is going on that makes you think that this is anxiety? And then I want you to kind of go back to something that you said earlier, which is that some people are preloaded for more sensitivity to, say, stress. And so I would love it if you could unpack that a little bit more and say what you mean by that.
Well, a lot of folks that I see maybe they came up from toxic environments. And there's the wonderful field of epigenetics and how things can affect us. They can boil under the surface. And I've developed some tools that kind of keep them at bay. And I'm still living my life pretty good. But adding an overwhelm event or an overwhelm season for 2 years, such as COVID, then these same tools aren't keeping this at bay anymore. And so I'm having this experience, and I keep doing my yoga, my meditation journal, all the tools that you were using, but it's the tools weren't matching the event anymore. And so that's where I want to find out, well, what have you been doing and how has the experience changed? And that's very subjective, because I can't, and that's why I ask those questions, because I can't sit there and define it, or I can't say, well, you shouldn't be experiencing that because you're doing all this stuff. And that's, I see that. I've seen folks where that has been a fatal flaw in their previous work, is they'll be totally activated, crawling out of their own skin, and then saying, but everything's okay because I'm doing this in there, and they can't even sit still. But they've been told to convince themselves that, well, that's not happening because you're doing this and you are stronger, you're smarter than this. And so I just said, well, let's just have just a real conversation about that. And it's got to feel awful. And let's just be honest about that. It feels awful. And what does it feel like? And that's where I really want to go to. And I don't want it feels like anxiety. I want, where is it? What is it doing? Where does it live? And honestly, Megan, that's a conversation that a lot of people had and never had. Because everything else is hypothetical. Because I could say, well, could it be this? And they could say, well, it could be this. And could it be this? Well, maybe it's this. And then we spend all of our time wrestling with hypotheticals. But I'd rather wrestle with the facts.
Right.
And facts are, I'm so uncomfortable in my own skin. And I can't sleep. My feet do this at night. And I can't sustain a thought. My stomach's in knots. And my arms are tingly. Those are the facts. All right, let's deal with the facts. Let's develop tools, internal tools around the facts. And you know what? There are so many awesome tools. We're in a great season of understanding trauma and anxiety and tools around those things. This leaps and bounds in the past 10, 15 years of understanding the tools that are going to help the body reclaim sovereignty without trying to figure out which needle in the haystack is the one activating me right now. So I'm just happy to be around during this season.
Yeah. And I think that's actually part of what contributes to the guilt and the shame in what I call like the suffering Olympics, where in the denial game that we play around our own suffering and need for support, is that we are living in kind of, you know, the easiest time where we have shelter and we have access to food, especially in the Western world. We have access to so many tools and resources and phones, and like technology has never made us more connected. And yet we feel this guilt and the shame that we would be suffering because we have life so good, right? How dare I suffer when so many people have it so much worse?
Well, and you know, that's a catch-22, because before the phone, before binge watching, I probably did more things that helped my body help me. I probably ate differently. We probably exercised more. We were probably more connected to community. All the things that we did previously, I mean, it's both of those are valid arguments. So saying that, well, there's no reason that I should be feeling like this. And you know what? Let's not, I don't want to get stuck on the reason. Let's just say you feel like this. And let's work from there. Let's have that be our foothold. I just feel like this. And whatever the rationale, let's get the body and the brain back in sync again. The I shouldn't feel like this. My PhD is in CBT. So I'm down with it, man. Okay. But it's primarily here. Logic, cause and effect, rationale, language, thinking it through. That's probably right there. But where we are in the season of understanding is this is a system. And the system has become distressed, not just one part of it where you say, I shouldn't be thinking this way. I shouldn't be feeling this way. That man, that's just one part of an entire system. Let's get the whole system. Let's help this, which empowers you. Man, I am so into that. And it's productive. It's, I love the proactivity of it, that we can do things that move the needle. And I think that's what people want. When, if somebody is in depression or trauma or anxiety, they want to do something to feel better. They want to be proactive about it. And that's what I like about, all right, let's rock the system then and help you do the things that are going to move the needle for you.
Yeah. And I'd love if you can talk about that system a little bit, because, you know, there are our thoughts, and a lot of people, I think they, if they think differently, they can just solve all their problems, right? This is a thought problem solely. And there's a sophisticated system of things working to keep you safe. And anxiety specifically, I just talk about it as like the illusion of control. We're just kind of like grasping at smoke when really there's an underlying fire we haven't paid attention to. And so if you could describe for me kind of this, that sophisticated system that's all at work in the background, and the things that you are in direct control over, and the things that you aren't, that are automatic responses that you can then inform with tools and practices.
Yeah. And this is part of the knowledge base, which has been booming, that the vagus nerve, the limbic system, and how the brain, my thought processing is miles away from where the stress centers of the brain are, and which is miles away from the vagus nerve. So somehow there's got to be a way that all this information interacts with each other that keeps us moving forward. And we've been stuck we'll just think it through. And again, I'm trained in that. I'm down. So I had to kind of sit back myself and say, okay, why are people who've been in therapy for decades still having this response? And what can I do differently? What where's the gap? What am I missing? And then Vietnam vets, for example, 50 years, and they woke up last night struggling. And so for me, it comes to the understanding, if we could have thought our way out of it, we would have by now. And for me, that is I'm going to go old school on you, Megan, the record playing in my head. Although records are coming back, but
they're very in right now.
In my head, when I'm meeting with somebody, because that's the model that's pervasive. Everybody understands that. Well, let me just tell you all about it. And I'll say, okay, we can do that, but I don't want us just to land there. And so looking at the research and how the gut affects dopamine, production, and that information travels all these highways. And so we as providers, as caregivers, as community members, as citizens, start leaning into, well, how can, if that's true, which it is true, what can I do to start being proactive in promoting that health, which promotes this health? And I think the beautiful new season of health in mental health is understanding the system. And I think we're kind of leaning into that now as a society. And maybe that's one of the blessings of COVID, is that we had to look at our health in a different way. And what can I do to immunity? How can I strengthen that which strengthens me? So I think that could be one of the positives that came out of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you couldn't orchestrate a more unified experience worldwide of a stressor of this extreme amount, right? Like, even if you tried, you couldn't orchestrate this kind of experiment. And so the fact that we've all shared, although, you know, everybody's experience was different and unique into themselves and their situation, we have all experienced the elevated stress and constraints and impacts of 2 years of ongoing kind of public crisis. And I want to go back to what you said about gut feelings and anxiety, because one of the things that I know people have often named about anxiety is a loss of like gut instinct, right? We name it as gut instinct because we tune into our bodies for answers to life's big questions, or to figure out what our next move should be, or how we should make a decision. And when you have anxiety and you're suffering from anxiety, I found that that intuition feels lost, and that contributes to the anxiety. You're like, well, my gut feels awful. I might be sick. I might have digestive issues. So how am I supposed to trust my gut when my gut feels terrible, right? And so how do we piece apart what is worry and what is intuition?
Those are two really interesting conversations. I mean, so thank you for bringing those up. One of the things that I've noticed clinically is if there is chronic stress or traumas, there's a separation. The stress and trauma separate what should be integrated and integrate what should be separated. So it integrates this moment and this sense of what I'm labeling stress and overwhelm. It integrates this whole thing of feels awful. Or it separates the mind from the body. Because the body has a lot of stressful information, has a lot of uncomfortable information. So I'd rather just not deal with it. But you can see there's a system that is lacking there. So part of the process is creating integration again in a healthy way, in a safe way, because not everything has to be overwhelmed. Sometimes it's just information. And that is the most empowering thing that the folks that I work with. That moment where they recognize the stomach, the gut thing, as my stomach feels funny right now. When I said, that's just information. It's just trying to tell you something. Rather than call it overwhelm or anxiety or stress, it's information. And that is such a victory. I've been given this information my whole life, and I have been running away from it because I've labeled it instantly something that is distressing to me. But really, it's job, that gut instinct was to protect you. And you know, and you're right, maybe sometimes that pendulum is just off, but getting to know it is how you start to recalibrate it, beginning to know that the environmental things and being comfortable with it. That's how you start to become sovereign with it, rather than just having to be the enemy. Because once you start become introduced to it, that's when you start playing nice together, slowly but surely. But you're right. If I grew up in toxicity, then everything is that. Everything is dangerous. But if they're sitting in this office or on a telepsych meeting, it's a safe moment. And that alarm, what's causing that alarm, isn't in reality occurring right now. But the more you lean into it, the more it says, what should I do here? Let's stay safe then. Let's recalibrate. And I just love seeing those moments. They happen, and they're genuine. And people, my favorite thing is like if we're breathing it down or we're doing some sort of tool with it, and they get this face. Like Snoopy, like after he's had his Thanksgiving meal and this. I love that moment. And here's what's I've learned from those moments is I'll ask, what does your body feel like? And they'll say things like, I don't want to throw up. My stomach's not tense. My heart's not pounding. My breathing's not out of control. My arms aren't tingling. So they're telling me all the things that aren't occurring right now, because that was probably their normal. And maybe for the first time, they've introduced their body to peace. And I'll just say, help them with a label. What if we called that peace? So rather than something to avoid, I'm avoiding this list of things here. What if we created something that they can pursue? And, you know, they've probably had little glimpses of it their whole life, but with the calibration being off all the time, they never just glommed onto it because it was foreign. So what if we created more opportunities that this exists and expand that window and spend more time in this, in developing the tools that make this thing happen? It's doable. It's possible. But it's not going to happen by accident. It's got to be, well, here's how I understand my system now. And here's what I do that creates this versus this. Or I get my first inkling of one of these things popping up. What do I do that widens this window that I can be in this experience rather than this experience? Ooh, I'm going to pound my desk. I love that. I'm excited about that stuff.
I love everything you said. And I love the kind of the subject object differentiation of all of the getting in tune with your body. First of all, if you've been avoiding it for a long, long time and somebody asks you to get in tune with it, even in that safe space and the secure and safe space of working with you, it's totally scary, right? Like everything's lit up and it exacerbates all those symptoms. And so just to pay attention, but then give them that tool to subject object differentiate. This is just information. Because for so many anxiety sufferers, especially, that information becomes just another thing to try to control, right? I'm going to avoid situations that make me feel that way, or I'm going to avoid foods, or I'm going, and some of that is helpful, right? Like I have a 12-year-old son who is very lactose intolerant, but also really likes ice cream, right? And so from a very young age, we've had to just kind of like create an awareness training, like, okay, so if you eat that ice cream, what's going to happen? Where do we need to be? Like information, feedback. Like I'm not going to create a thing, an anxiety around him and ice cream. He just needs information and understanding to release the anxiety around it. Otherwise there will be impacts that will create awkward social situations for him. Right. So, but it's creating that information, remove like subject object thing where it's like, this is just information and I can take that information in a safe environment and withstand it, right? And sustain the discomfort instead of constantly avoiding it. I think that's a powerful step.
And you know, a couple things. Once you feel sovereign over that, then you go into the awesome CBT space with meaning changes. And once meaning changes and I have sovereignty over my responses, that's a different world. What becomes distressful when we're looking at, well, how can I be, we don't want to create hypervigilance. We don't want to train hypervigilance in, well, you should be, watch out for that. Watch. I get it with the ice cream, but if I train everyone, that in itself is distressful for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So what I want to think about, just even my three kids at home, is how can I have them feel sovereign and autonomous and strong in any one of these things that comes along. So they have the tools that this comes along. What do they have? Now we talk about the ABCs. Always be cool. And that's a funny thing, but what does cool feel like? Which is I'm regulated, I have a regulated heart rate. I have regulated breathing. So what tools do I have to ABC in any of these situations? Because I work with a lot of folks that had become shut-ins, basically, because I go here and I feel this way, I go here, I feel this way, I go here, I feel this way. And you know, it could be one of any millions of inputs. So we're not going to control all the millions of inputs. What we control is my response then. But it's got to be practiced at home a bunch. So the system fires and wires in a different way that when I get in those situations, oh, I know what this is. And I've practiced this. We don't have a fire drill in the middle of a fire, right? Because you have a fire drill in the middle of a fire and everybody stands up screaming, what do I do? You have a fire drill 10 times in case there's a fire. Do you know what to do, where to go, how to respond in the middle of the fire? So the things we do ahead of time, all the time, practicing a lifestyle, honestly, Megan, of health and wellness, that taking care of that which takes care of me, practicing that lifestyle on an ongoing basis, practicing the heart rate variability breathing just all the time, just driving down the road, walking your dog, practicing the breathing that helps with regulation just all the time. And maybe coincidentally then, that number of things that previously caused a response. There's fewer of those. I just did an Elmer Fudd thing or a Porky Pig thing there. So there's fewer of those things, coincidentally, because I've been doing all this ahead of time. And the world expands. And anxiety wants constriction of your life. But sovereignty and autonomy, it wants expansion. And the more we practice these things, there's expansion and expansion and expansion. You get more of that face, which is what we're looking for.
And I know that you've talked about sovereignty and stacking sovereign moments a lot. And I think that that comes into play with what you're talking about, practicing the fire drill before the fire, because a lot of what happens in anxiety and definitely trauma responses is that your rational thinking brain is taken offline. Your amygdala takes over and it's just kind of in like survival mode, right? And so we're often not in control of our initial response to whatever the stressor might be. But what we are responsible for and able to respond to is the next thing that we do, right? And so, but that's why it's so irritating if your heart rate's up and your breathing is off and somebody comes up and goes, take a deep breath, but you haven't practiced what it feels like to re-regulate your heart rate and take a deep breath, you want to punch that person in the face. I don't condone assault, but like if somebody comes up to me when I'm hyperventilating and they're like, take a deep breath, I'm like, you should get away from me, arm's length, definitely, right? Because you don't understand what's happening right now. I'm not in control. But if you have practiced that and you've stacked up those little sovereign moments, as you call them, then when that happens and somebody comes and says that in a well-meaning way, then you know what they mean and you know you've done it. You're like, oh, right. It's like your teacher in the classroom. We've practiced our fire drills. Everybody go to their spot. And that reminder, you're like, oh, right. I know what my job is. I know where to go.
Right. And part of that is how is... encourage folks to know what's that first thing. I smell smoke. So what do you do when you smell smoke? So where is it? What does it do? And really become familiar with that. Become familiar with the body. That's where all these victories are going to occur. I've had people say, I get this thing in my chest. A tightening right here. I've heard people say I get a fluttering in my stomach, or I get dizzy. And they're telling you, well, here's a, here's the information I get that I just run with historically. So, okay. And so we stop. We during our fire drills, then when you get that information, here's what we do next. And then you're right. When somebody could, when somebody says, why don't you breathe? That's what I do. That's my tool. And the more you practice it, the more that just becomes the way of bringing it back, opening that, broadening that window. And the more you practice that, the more really the system says, I know what this is. I know what you're doing now, because we never did this before. But now that you're doing this, I get it. So you take that first breath and says, so this is just like those things we've been practicing 1,000 times. Got it. And the system sits. And I use that a lot. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know why I'm adopting that. Whereas just say, sit. And it just kind of sits and says, dude, okay, I get it. And that's that sovereign moment. And then I want people to acknowledge, you know, I just controlled that. That's a victory. I want people to really spend time saying that didn't happen before. It's happening now. It's a new season now. And I want people to really claim those things.
I actually totally resonated with when you were like, sit, because, you know, if we're talking about like animal behavior, dogs, especially if anybody's a dog person, oftentimes animals will display anxious behavior because their human is not reacting the way they want them to about the anxiety or the information that they've received. Right. And so when you take back control, and let's say that the dog is your nervous system at this point, and you're like, sit, I got this. Then the dog sits and it relaxes and it's like, oh, you're in charge. You know, you see what I see. You have the information I have and you're in charge. Got it. I'll relax. I'm going to go off alert now because I trust you. Right. And that's what kind of what you're teaching your entire system is like, that you can be trusted with the stimulus and response, and that you've got the tools and behaviors ready to take care of yourself and keep yourself safe.
And I think as you say, that surrounding, talking to people in your community about these things, surrounding yourself with safe people that get it, that are going to cheer you on, that aren't going to say, oh, you're just acting crazy. That aren't going to say, have you ever thought about just calming down? Because again, you want to punch them in the throat, because that's the wrong tool. But if you had the person in your community that says, oh, this looks tough, let's do this together. Let's use these, our robust toolbox to bring you back. Let's practice that together. And I love the saying, community is not the problem, community is the solution. I love that. And because the more we create that specific group of people that we've had this conversation with, and maybe they have the same experience, and maybe you're part of their community, that we start bouncing these thoughts and ideas and hope and help off of each other, that you've kind of created a safer area for yourself because people are around you are supporting that and recognize the tools and practice the tools with you. I just love that. I'll say it again. Community is not the problem. Community is the solution. And unfortunately, during COVID season, we were told that community was the problem. But now I want us to understand that community is the solution.
I love that framing. And I've also heard you say before several times that we suffer in silos and we thrive in community. And so I'm going to quote you to you.
That's brilliant.
It's brilliant. A wise man once said that. But I also think, you know, that we have an unreasonable expectation that our communities of closest relations, so our, you know, our family systems that we've either come from or created ourselves, our best friends, are going to be able to meet us where we are. And sometimes our unique journeys, our unique sufferings, just like, I don't want to participate in my husband's fantasy football league, but he's not even in one. So I just made that up. But like, I don't care. I'm not interested in that. Right. Like, I just don't, it's not something that fires me up. He can have that. Right. But so, and I don't expect him to be fired up about trauma and anxiety research. Right. So I need to create the community that supports my interests and my growth. And hopefully we grow together in a lot of ways as well. But just because your family of origin or the family you've created don't understand or support your journey in that way doesn't mean that you can't find it, even when your local community, for reasons of geography or isolation or ability, aren't available to you, we are more connected than ever. There's literally a group for everything online that you can find support in and find people on the same path as you.
Creating a community of support. I think you said that, at least what I gleaned out of
that. A wise woman once said, create a community of support.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. And you're right, we have more opportunity. And this is one of the things that, a good thing that comes out of the technology, is we have more opportunity for that than ever. When we were on farms and raising our own food, which had its great stuff as well, we just didn't, but that was the community. And so now we have an opportunity to use technology to in ways that it can enhance wellness instead of become a way of dissociating. So I love that. I think maybe part of our own personal growth and development is taking those, the best of those things, and just taking what your husband can give you as far as a fake nod about your trauma and anxiety research, and you give him a fake nod about his fantasy football league.
Exactly. I mean, we've literally just taught each other a phrase that's just like, that sounds really interesting. I'm so happy for you, right? That's just code for like, I'm listening. I hear everything you say. I don't care. I'm sorry. I'm not going to join you here, but I'm very happy for you. It's much less demeaning than it sounds in real life, though, I promise. So we've kind of talked around, just before I let you go, we've talked around kind of practices, and you've mentioned some things, but I would love if you could tell us like one practice that you give people to help them create that internal, to touch that internal peace and sovereignty that we've talked about so far.
So I love the recent heart rate variability breathing. And people will say, well, just breathe. Everybody says that. And so people come in and say, okay, I'm just going to breathe. But I'll say, well, no, let's talk about let's do it right. So my favorite part of the group of research that I've seen for heart variability is the breathing in through the nose for the three counts and pausing and then exhaling through the mouth for seven counts. Did I flute breathe for you last time?
No, I don't think so.
Well, you just poked the bear, Megan. Okay. So I tell people when I play flute, I don't blow, I just breathe. And it really emulates heart rate variability breathing, where it's three counts in a pause and seven counts out. Like, so we know the research that the inhale through the nose activates the sympathetic system, and the exhale through the mouth activates the parasympathetic, the calming, digestion, all the stuff like that. But it doesn't pop over, it blooms over. So that's a flute note. So you breathe in and you're actually creating heart rate variability. And then acetylcholine is released to slow the heart rate. So you're just affecting the entire system. So an oversimplification is just breathe, but there's so much going on physiologically. And so what I have folks do is I'll have them recognize the information. And then I'll tell them, well, let's breathe that down. And the magic number is like 6 to 7 cycles of doing that. And I've had people make that grin. And I'll say, what's happening now? They say, it's not happening anymore. And they'd say, I used to wrestle with this for about an hour, 2 hours. It would just be present and very limiting. But they claimed it and said, well, I'm just going to do this now. And so I'll say, just pay attention to your breathing. Look at the information. Don't try to change it. It'll change on its own. And just let it happen. And so flute breathing, I haven't done this for you.
You did play, you gave me the anecdote in our last talk for the Trauma Super Conference about the little boy that the one with the snot pouring out of his nose, and you, instead of telling him to take a deep breath because you're smarter than that, you played the flute and then handed it to him and let him play it. So yes, you did play me a little flute as part of that anecdote.
So I do that with the folks here. I'll say, as long as you see me breathing in, you breathe with me. And I'll And I'll make sure that I'm kind of counting in my mind, three in, seven out, three in, seven out. And I'll do 6 to 7 cycles. But I love that that's a device where they can, well, that crazy psychologist was playing flute in his office for me. I want them to know, well, what was the purpose of that? Well, that's flute breathing. That's heart rate variability breathing. And so the tool, the portable, simple tool is flute breathing whenever you get that information, 6 to 7 cycles. And just pay attention to information. I've had a lot of people tell me that it moved. So it was stomach, and then, oh, my leg hurts, then my back hurts. It moved, but I said, well, let's just do the same thing. Let's just do the same thing and create sovereignty and create autonomy in these moments rather than it being a bully to them. Them using just simple tools to tell it to sit.
I imagine something like blowing bubbles might work as well. Or I could unhide my children's recorders that mysteriously disappeared during quarantine.
Or pinwheels from Dollar General, like that. But a lot of kids will see how fast they can make it go. That's not the game. You want to see if they make it go longer than you. And then you run out of breath at about 7 seconds.
And then
So there's all sorts of ways to get folks to practice that and that in the way that is comfortable for them.
And that's also why I love bubbles. And by the way, like, bubbles are great for kids, but I found bubbles are also great for adults. Like, I use this stuff, but in order to blow a big bubble, you have to blow slower and steadier. And so, but you know, if you blow fast, like you said, with the pinwheel, you get a bunch of bubbles, little tiny small bubbles. But if you blow slow and steady, you get a big bubble. Not that I've done this a lot.
Well, you know, I don't want to ruin my carpet with the bubble, but I'll say we're for activity now in the middle of winter here in New York. But I do like the idea of making a big bubble. I might have to Bogart that.
Yeah. And in fact, not to, you know, just another tip. I made during COVID, it was a long quarantine for us. We made those big giant mega bubble wands that you can just make with literally two sticks from the yard and some yarn. And so that was also like when you would get all, you know, activated by each other from homeschooling at home, we would go outside and make giant bubbles because sometimes just a bubble wand was just not enough to re-regulate.
Did you have to blow into those big?
No, you put it's more of a, you know, an activity, but you put all the bubble solution in a bucket instead and, you know, just scale it all up. And yeah, you definitely don't want to do that indoors. That's, you know, you're going to get your shoes and your legs and your arms covered, but.
I'll say this is therapeutic, but actually I'm cleaning my carpet.
Exactly. Daryl Tonema, thank you so much for being with us today. How can people find out more about you, your work, and your music for that matter?
Ooh, can I show them this?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so
it's upside down. Flip it over.
Here we go.
Funny guy.
Okay, so this is The Singing Psychologist. That's our podcast. It's on all the platforms. And our telehealth is First Nations telehealth. And the trainings that we do is Tonema Consulting. And yeah, so we talk about all that stuff on The Singing Psychologist. I'm just really enjoying doing The Singing Psychologist. It's a podcast. It's not a webcast yet because they don't have the fancy microphones and things that you have. I don't know how to make that work here in my office, but come join us. I would welcome everybody.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for being on this today.
Thank you. Take care of yourself.